dear, he's as white as a sheet," various voices were heard saying. Petya soon came to himself. The colour returned to his face, the pain had passed, and at the cost of that temporary unpleasantness he had obtained a place by the cannon from where he hoped to see the Emperor, who would be returning that way. Petya no longer thought of presenting his petition. If he could only see the Emperor, he would be happy. While the service was proceeding in the Cathedral of the Assumption, it was a combined service of prayer on the occasion of the Emperor's arrival and of thanksgiving for the conclusion of peace with the Turks. The crowd outside spread out, and hawkers appeared, selling kvass, gingerbread, and poppy seed sweets, of which Petya was particularly fond, and ordinary conversation could again be heard. A tradesman's wife was showing a rent in her shawl and telling how much the shawl had cost. Another was saying that all silk goods had now got dear. The clerk who had rescued Petya was talking to a functionary about the priests who were officiating that day with the bishop. The clerk several times used the word plenary of the service, a word Petya did not understand. Two young citizens were joking with some serf girls who were cracking nuts. All these conversations, especially the joking with the girls, were such as might have had a particular charm for Petya at his age. But they did not interest him now. He sat on his elevation, the pedestal of the cannon, still agitated as before by the thought of the Emperor and by his love for him. The feeling of pain and fear he had experienced when he was being crushed, together with that of rapture, still further intensified his sense of the importance of the occasion. Suddenly the sound of a firing of cannon was heard from the embankment to celebrate the signing of peace with the Turks, and the crowd rushed impetuously toward the embankment to watch the firing. Petya too would have run there, but the clerk who had taken the young gentleman under his protection stopped him. The firing was still proceeding when officers, generals, and gentlemen-in-waiting came running out of the cathedral, and after them others in a more leisurely manner. Caps were again raised, and those who had run to look at the cannon ran back again. At last, four men in uniforms and sashes emerged from the cathedral doors. "Hurrah! Hurrah!" shouted the crowd again. "Which is he? Which?" asked Petya in a tearful voice of those around him, but no one answered him. Everybody was too excited. And Petya, fixing on one of those four men whom he could not clearly see for the tears of joy that filled his eyes, concentrated all his enthusiasm on him, though it happened not to be the Emperor, frantically shouted, "Hurrah!" and resolved that tomorrow, come what might, he would join the army. The crowd ran after the Emperor, followed him to the palace, and began to disperse. It was already late, and Petya had not eaten anything and was drenched with perspiration. Yet he did not go home, but stood with that diminishing but still considerable crowd before the palace while the Emperor dined, looking at the palace windows, expecting he knew not what, and envying alike the notables he saw arriving at the entrance to dine with the Emperor, and the court footmen who served at table, glimpses of whom could be seen through the windows. While the Emperor was dining, Valuev, looking out of the window, said, "The people are still hoping to see Your Majesty again." The dinner was nearly over, and the Emperor, munching a biscuit, rose and went out onto the balcony. The people, with Petya among them, rushed toward the balcony. "Angel, dear one, hurrah! Father!" cried the crowd, and Petya with it, and again the women and men of weaker mould, Petya among them, wept with joy. A largish piece of the biscuit the Emperor was holding in his hand broke off, fell on the balcony parapet, and then to the ground. A coachman in a jerkin who stood nearest sprang forward and snatched it up. Several people in the crowd rushed at the coachman. Seeing this, the Emperor had a plateful of biscuits brought him and began throwing them down from the balcony. Petya's eyes grew bloodshot, and still more excited by the danger of being crushed, he rushed at the biscuits. He did not know why, but he had to have a biscuit from the Tsar's hand, and he felt that he must not give way. He sprang forward and upset an old woman who was catching at a biscuit. The old woman did not consider herself defeated, though she was lying on the ground. She grabbed at some biscuits, but her hand did not reach them. Petya pushed her hand away with his knee, seized a biscuit, and as if fearing to be too late, again shouted, "Hurrah!" with a voice already hoarse. The emperor went in, and after that the greater part of the crowd began to disperse.
"There! I said if only we waited, and so it was
being joyfully said by various people. Happy as Petya was, he felt sad at having to go home, knowing that all the enjoyment of that day was over. He did not go straight home from the Kremlin, but called on his friend Obolensky, who was 15 and was also entering the regiment. On returning home, Petya announced resolutely and firmly that if he was not allowed to enter the service, he would run away. And next day, Count Ilya Rostov, though he had not yet quite yielded, went to inquire how he could arrange for Petya to serve where there would be least danger. Chapter 22. Assembly of Gentry and Merchants at the Sloboda Palace. 2 days later, on the 15th of July, an immense number of carriages were standing outside the Sloboda Palace. The great halls were full. In the first were the nobility and gentry in their uniforms, in the second, bearded merchants in full-skirted coats of blue cloth and wearing medals. In the nobleman's hall there was an incessant movement and buzz of voices. The chief magnates sat on high-backed chairs at a large table under the portrait of the emperor, but most of the gentry were strolling about the room. All these nobles, whom Pierre met every day at the club or in their own houses, were in uniform, some in that of Catherine's day, others in that of Emperor Paul, others again in the new uniforms of Alexander's time or the ordinary uniform of the nobility, and the general characteristic of being in uniform imparted something strange and fantastic to these diverse and familiar personalities, both young and old. The old men, dim-eyed, toothless, bald, sallow and bloated, or gaunt and wrinkled, were especially striking. For the most part they sat quietly in their places and were silent, or if they walked about and talked, attached themselves to someone younger. On all these faces, as on the faces of the crowd Petya had seen in the square, there was a striking contradiction. The general expectation of a solemn event, and at the same time the everyday interests in a Boston card party, Peter the cook, Zinaida Dmitrievna's health, and so on. Pierre was there too, buttoned up since early morning in a nobleman's uniform that had become too tight for him. He was agitated. This extraordinary gathering, not only of nobles but also of the merchant class, les états généraux, states general, evoked in him a whole series of ideas he had long laid aside, but which were deeply graven in his soul, thoughts of the contrat social and the French Revolution. The words that had struck him in the emperor's appeal, that the sovereign was coming to the capital for consultation with his people, strengthened this idea. And imagining that in this direction something important which he had long awaited was drawing near, he strolled about, watching and listening to conversations, but nowhere finding any confirmation of the ideas that occupied him. The emperor's manifesto was read, evoking enthusiasm, and then all moved about discussing it. Besides the ordinary topics of conversation, Pierre heard questions of where the marshals of the nobility were to stand when the emperor entered, when a ball should be given in the emperor's honour, whether they should group themselves by districts or by whole provinces, and so on. But as soon as the war was touched on, or what the nobility had been convened for, the talk became undecided and indefinite. Then all preferred listening to speaking. A middle-aged man, handsome and virile, in the uniform of a retired naval officer, was speaking in one of the rooms, and a small crowd was pressing round him. Pierre went up to the circle that had formed round the speaker and listened. Count Ilya Rostov, in a military uniform of Catherine's time, was sauntering with a pleasant smile among the crowd, with all of whom he was acquainted. He too approached that group and listened with a kindly smile and nods of approval, as he always did, to what the speaker was saying. The retired naval man was speaking very boldly, as was evident from the expression on the faces of the listeners, and from the fact that some people Pierre knew as the meekest and quietest of men walked away disapprovingly or expressed disagreement with him. Pierre pushed his way into the middle of the group, listened, and convinced himself that the man was indeed a liberal, but of views quite different from his own. The naval officer spoke in a particularly sonorous, musical and aristocratic baritone voice, pleasantly swallowing his R's and generally slurring his consonants. The voice of a man calling out to his servant, "Here, bring me my pipe!" It was indicative of dissipation and the exercise of authority. "What if Smolensk people have offered to raise militia for the Emperor? Are we to take Smolensk as our pattern? If the noble aristocracy of the province of Moscow thinks fit, it can show its loyalty to our sovereign, the Emperor, in other ways. Have we forgotten the raising of the militia in the year 7? All that did was to enrich the priest's sons and thieves and robbers." Count Ilya Rostov smiled blandly and nodded approval. "And was our militia of any use to the Emperor? Not at all. It only ruined our farming. Better have another conscription, or our men will return neither soldiers nor peasants, and we'll get only depravity from them. The nobility don't grudge their lives. Every one of us will go and bring in more recruits, and the sovereign," that was the way he referred to the Emperor, "need only say the word and we'll all die for him," added the orator with animation. Count Rostov's mouth watered with pleasure, and he nudged Pierre. But Pierre wanted to speak himself. He pushed forward, feeling stirred, but not yet sure what stirred him or what he would say. Scarcely had he opened his mouth when one of the senators, a man without a tooth in his head, with a shrewd enough though angry expression standing near the first speaker, interrupted him. Evidently accustomed to managing debates and to maintaining an argument, he began in low but distinct tones. "I imagine, sir," said he, mumbling with his toothless mouth, "that we have been summoned here not to discuss whether it's best for the Empire at the present moment to adopt conscription or to call out the militia. We have been summoned to reply to the appeal with which our sovereign, the Emperor, has honoured us. But to judge what is best, conscription or the militia, we can leave to the supreme authority." Pierre suddenly saw an outlet for his excitement. He hardened his heart against the senator, who was introducing this set and narrow attitude, into the deliberations of the nobility. Pierre stepped forward and interrupted him. He himself did not yet know what he would say, but he began to speak eagerly, occasionally lapsing into French or expressing himself in bookish Russian. "Excuse me, Your Excellency," he began. He was well acquainted with the senator, but thought it necessary on this occasion to address him formally. "Though I don't agree with the gentleman," he hesitated. He wished to say, "mon très honorable préopinant," my very honourable opponent, "with the gentleman whom I have not the honour of knowing, I suppose that the nobility have been summoned not merely to express their sympathy and enthusiasm, but also to consider the means by which we can assist our fatherland. I imagine," he went on, warming to his subject, "that the Emperor himself would not be satisfied to find in us merely owners of serfs whom we are willing to devote to his service, and chair à canon, cannon fodder, we are ready to make of ourselves, and not to obtain from us any counsel." Many persons withdrew from the circle, noticing the senator's sarcastic smile and the freedom of Pierre's remarks. Only Count Rostov was pleased with them, as he had been pleased with those of the naval officer, the senator, and in general with whatever speech he had last heard. "I think that before discussing these questions," Pierre continued, "we should ask the Emperor, most respectfully ask His Majesty, to let us know the number of our troops and the position in which our army and our forces now are, and then..." But scarcely had Pierre uttered these words before he was attacked from three sides. The most vigorous attack came from an old acquaintance, a Boston player who had always been well-disposed toward him, Stepan Stepanovich Adraksin. Adraksin was in uniform, and whether as a result of the uniform or from some other cause, Pierre saw before him quite a different man. With a sudden expression of malevolence on his aged face, Adraksin shouted at Pierre,
"In the first place, I tell you we have no right to question the Emperor about that. And secondly, if the Russian nobility had that right, the Emperor could not answer such a question. The troops are moved according to the enemy's movements, and the number of men increases and decreases."
Another voice, that of a nobleman of medium height and about 40 years of age, whom Pierre had formerly met at the Gypsies and knew as a bad card player, and who also transformed by his uniform, came up to Pierre, interrupted Adraksin.
"Yes, and this is not a time for discussing," he continued, "but for acting. There is war in Russia. The enemy is advancing to destroy Russia, to desecrate the tomb of our fathers, to carry off our wives and children." The nobleman smote his breast. "We will arise, every one of us will go for our father, the Tsar," he shouted, rolling his bloodshot eyes.
Several approving voices were heard in the crowd.
"We are Russians, and will not grudge our blood in defence of our faith, the throne, and the fatherland. We must cease raving if we are sons of our fatherland. We will show Europe how Russia rises to the defence of Russia."
Pierre wished to reply, but could not get in a word. He felt that his words, apart from what meaning they conveyed, were less audible than the sound of his opponent's voice. Count Rostov, at the back of the crowd, was expressing approval. Several persons, briskly turning a shoulder to the orator at the end of a phrase, said,
"That's right, quite right, just so."
Pierre wished to say that he was ready to sacrifice his money, his serfs, or himself, only one ought to know the state of affairs in order to be able to improve it, but he was unable to speak. Many voices shouted and talked at the same time, so that Count Rostov had not time to signify his approval of them all, and the group increased, dispersed, reformed, and then moved with a hum of talk into the largest hall and to the big table. Not only was Pierre's attempt to speak unsuccessful, but he was rudely interrupted, pushed aside, and people turned away from him as from a common enemy. This happened not because they were displeased by the substance of his speech, which had even been forgotten after the many subsequent speeches, but to animate it, the crowd needed a tangible object to love and a tangible object to hate. Pierre became the latter. Many other orators spoke after the excited nobleman, and all in the same tone. Many spoke eloquently and with originality. Glinka, the editor of the Russian Messenger, who was recognized, cries of "Author! Author!" were heard in the crowd, said that hell must be repulsed by hell, and that he had seen a child smiling at lightning flashes and thunderclaps, but "we will not be that child." "Yes, yes, at thunderclaps," was repeated approvingly in the back rows of the crowd. The crowd drew up to the large table, at which sat grey-haired or bald 70-year-old magnates, uniformed and besashed, almost all of whom Pierre had seen in their own homes with their buffoons or playing Boston at the clubs. With an incessant hum of voices, the crowd advanced to the table. Pressed by the throng against the high backs of the chairs, the orators spoke one after another, and sometimes two together. Those standing behind noticed what a speaker omitted to say and hastened to supply it. Others in that heat and crush racked their brains to find some thought and hastened to utter it. The old magnates, whom Pierre knew, sat and turned to look first at one and then at another, and their faces for the most part only expressed the fact that they found it very hot. Pierre, however, felt excited, and the general desire to show that they were ready to go to all lengths, which found expression in the tones and looks more than in the substance of the speeches, infected him too. He did not renounce his opinions, but felt himself in some way to blame and wished to justify himself.
"I only said that it would be more to the purpose to make sacrifices when we know what is needed," said he, trying to be heard above the other voices.
One of the old men nearest to him looked round, but his attention was immediately diverted by an exclamation at the other side of the table.
"Yes, Moscow will be surrendered! She will be our expiation!"
shouted one man.
"He is the enemy of mankind!"
cried another.
"Allow me to speak! Gentlemen, you're crushing me!"
Chapter 23. The Emperor Calls for the Support of the Gentry. At that moment Count Rostopchin, with his protruding chin and alert eyes, wearing the uniform of a general with sash over his shoulder, entered the room, stepping briskly to the front of the crowd of gentry.
"Our sovereign, the Emperor, will be here in a moment," said Rostopchin. "I am straight from the palace. Seeing the position we are in, I think there is little need for discussion. The Emperor has deigned to summon us and the merchants. Millions will pour forth from there." He pointed to the merchant's hall. "But our business is to supply men and not spare ourselves. That is the least we can do."
A conference took place confined to the magnates sitting at the table. The whole consultation passed more than quietly. After all the preceding noise, the sound of their old voices saying one after another, "I agree," or for variety, "I too am of that opinion," and so on, had even a mournful effect. The secretary was told to write down the resolution of the Moscow nobility and gentry, that they would furnish 10 men, fully equipped, out of every 1,000 serfs, as the Smolensk gentry had done. Their chairs made a scraping noise as the gentlemen who had conferred rose with apparent relief and began walking up and down arm in arm to stretch their legs and converse in couples.
"The Emperor! The Emperor!"
A sudden cry resounded through the halls, and the whole throng hurried to the entrance. The Emperor entered the hall through a broad path between 2 lines of nobles. Every face expressed respectful, awestruck curiosity. Pierre stood rather far off and could not hear all that the Emperor said. From what he did hear, he understood that the Emperor spoke of the danger threatening the Empire and of the hopes he placed on the Moscow nobility. He was answered by a voice which informed him of the resolution just arrived at.
"Gentlemen," said the Emperor with a quivering voice.
There was a rustling among the crowd, and it again subsided, so that Pierre distinctly heard the pleasantly human voice of the Emperor saying with emotion,
"I never doubted the devotion of the Russian nobles, but today it has surpassed my expectations. I thank you in the name of the fatherland. Gentlemen, let us act. Time is most precious."
The Emperor ceased speaking. The crowd began pressing round him, and rapturous exclamations were heard from all sides.
"Yes, most precious, a royal word," said Count Rostov with a sob.
He stood at the back, and though he had hardly heard anything, understood everything in his own way. From the hall of the nobility, the Emperor went to that of the merchants. There he remained about 10 minutes. Pierre was among those who saw him come out from the merchants' hall with tears of emotion in his eyes. As became known later, he had scarcely begun to address the merchants before tears gushed from his eyes and he concluded in a trembling voice. When Pierre saw the Emperor, he was coming out accompanied by 2 merchants, one of whom Pierre knew, a fat vintner. The other was the mayor, a man with a thin, sallow face and narrow beard. Both were weeping. Tears filled the thin man's eyes, and the fat vintner sobbed outright like a child and kept repeating,
"Our lives and property! Take them, Your Majesty!"
Pierre's one feeling at the moment was a desire to show that he was ready to go all lengths and was prepared to sacrifice everything. He now felt ashamed of his speech with its constitutional tendency and sought an opportunity of effacing it. Having heard that Count Mamonov was furnishing a regiment, Bezukhov had once informed Rostopchin that he would give 1,000 men and their maintenance. Old Rostov could not tell his wife of what had passed without tears, and at once consented to Petya's request and went himself to enter his name. Next day the Emperor left Moscow. The assembled nobles all took off their uniforms and settled down again in their homes and clubs, and not without some groans gave orders to their stewards about the enrolment, feeling amazed themselves at what they had done. Book 10, 1812. Chapter 1. Reflections on the Campaign of 1812. Napoleon began the war with Russia because he could not resist going to Dresden, could not help having his head turned by the homage he received, could not help donning a Polish uniform and yielding to the stimulating influence of a June morning, and could not refrain from bursts of anger in the presence of Kurakin and then of Balashov. Alexander refused negotiations because he felt himself to be personally insulted. Barclay de Tolly tried to command the army in the best way because he wished to fulfil his duty and earn fame as a great commander. Rostov charged the French because he could not restrain his wish for a gallop across a level field. And in the same way, the innumerable people who took part in the war acted in accord with their personal characteristics, habits, circumstances, and aims. They were moved by fear or vanity, rejoiced or were indignant, reasoned, imagining that they knew what they were doing and did it of their own free will. But they all were involuntary tools of history, carrying on a work concealed from them but comprehensible to us. Such is the inevitable fate of men of action, and the higher they stand in the social hierarchy, the less are they free. The actors of 1812 have long since left the stage. Their personal interests have vanished, leaving no trace, and nothing remains of that time but its historic results. Providence compelled all these men, striving to attain personal aims, to further the accomplishment of a stupendous result no one of them at all expected, neither Napoleon nor Alexander, nor still less any of those who did the actual fighting. The cause of the destruction of the French army in 1812 is clear to us now. No one will deny that that cause was, on the one hand, its advance into the heart of Russia late in the season, without any preparation for a winter campaign, and on the other, the character given to the war by the burning of Russian towns and the hatred of the foe this aroused among the Russian people. But no one at the time foresaw what now seems so evident, that this was the only way an army of 800,000 men, the best in the world and led by the best general, could be destroyed in conflict with a raw army of half its numerical strength and led by inexperienced commanders as the Russian army was. Not only did no one see this, but on the Russian side every effort was made to hinder the only thing that could save Russia, while on the French side, despite Napoleon's experience and so-called military genius, every effort was directed to pushing on to Moscow at the end of the summer, that is, to doing the very thing that was bound to lead to destruction. In historical works on the year 1812, French writers are very fond of saying that Napoleon felt the danger of extending his line, that he sought a battle, and that his marshals advised him to stop at Smolensk, and of making similar statements to show that the danger of the campaign was even then understood. Russian authors are still fonder of telling us that from the commencement of the campaign, a Scythian war plan was adopted to lure Napoleon into the depths of Russia, and this plan some of them attributed to Pfuel, others to a certain Frenchman, others to Toll, and others again to Alexander himself, pointing to notes, projects, and letters which contain hints of such a line of action. But all these hints at what happened, both from the French side and the Russian, are advanced only because they fit in with the event. Had that event not occurred, these hints would have been forgotten, as we have forgotten the thousands and millions of hints and expectations to the contrary which were current then, but have now been forgotten, because the event falsified them. There are always so many conjectures as to the issue of any event that, however it may end, there will always be people to say, "I said then that it would be so," quite forgetting that amid their innumerable conjectures, many were to quite the contrary effect. Conjectures as to Napoleon's awareness of the danger of extending his line, and, on the Russian side, as to luring the enemy into the depths of Russia, are evidently of that kind, and only by much straining can historians attribute such conceptions to Napoleon and his marshals, or such plans to the Russian commanders. All the facts are in flat contradiction to such conjectures. During the whole period of the war, not only was there no wish on the Russian side to draw the French into the heart of the country, but from their first entry into Russia, everything was done to stop them. And not only was Napoleon not afraid to extend his line, but he welcomed every step forward as a triumph, and did not seek battle as eagerly as in former campaigns, but very lazily. At the very beginning of the war, our armies were divided, and our sole aim was to unite them, though uniting the armies was no advantage if we meant to retire and lure the enemy into the depths of the country. Our emperor joined the army to encourage it to defend every inch of Russian soil and not to retreat. The enormous Drissa camp was formed on Fuel's plan, and there was no intention of retiring farther. The emperor reproached the commanders-in-chief for every step they retired. He could not bear the idea of letting the enemy even reach Smolensk, still less could he contemplate the burning of Moscow. And when our armies did unite, he was displeased that Smolensk was abandoned and burned without a general engagement having been fought under its walls. So thought the emperor, and the Russian commanders and people were still more provoked at the thought that our forces were retreating into the depths of the country. Napoleon, having cut our armies apart, advanced far into the country and missed several chances of forcing an engagement. In August he was at Smolensk, and thought only of how to advance farther, though, as we now see, that advance was evidently ruinous to him. The facts clearly show that Napoleon did not foresee the danger of the advance on Moscow, nor did Alexander and the Russian commanders then think of luring Napoleon on, but quite the contrary. The luring of Napoleon into the depths of the country was not the result of any plan, for no one believed it to be possible. It resulted from a most complex interplay of intrigues, aims, and wishes among those who took part in the war, and had no perception whatever of the inevitable or of the one way of saving Russia. Everything came about fortuitously. The armies were divided at the commencement of the campaign. We tried to unite them with the evident intention of giving battle and checking the enemy's advance, and by this effort to unite them while avoiding battle with a much stronger enemy, and necessarily withdrawing the armies at an acute angle, we led the French on to Smolensk. But we withdrew at an acute angle, not only because the French advanced between our two armies. The angle became still more acute, and we withdrew still farther, because Barclay de Tolly was an unpopular foreigner, disliked by Bagration, who would come under his command. And Bagration, being in command of the Second Army, tried to postpone joining up and coming under Barclay's command as long as he could. Bagration was slow in effecting the junction, though that was the chief aim of all at headquarters, because, as he alleged, he exposed his army to danger on this march, and it was best for him to retire more to the left and more to the south, worrying the enemy from flank and rear, and securing from the Ukraine recruits for his army. And it looks as if he planned this in order not to come under the command of the detested foreigner Barclay, whose rank was inferior to his own. The emperor was with the army to encourage it, but his presence and ignorance of what steps to take, and the enormous number of advisers and plans, destroyed the First Army's energy, and it retired. The intention was to make a stand at the Drissa camp, but Paolucci, aiming at becoming commander-in-chief, unexpectedly employed his energy to influence Alexander, and Fuel's whole plan was abandoned and the command entrusted to Barclay. But as Barclay did not inspire confidence, his power was limited. The armies were divided, there was no unity of command, and Barclay was unpopular. But from this confusion, division, and the unpopularity of the foreign commander-in-chief, there resulted on the one hand indecision and the avoidance of a battle, which we could not have refrained from had the armies been united and had someone else instead of Barclay been in command, and on the other an ever-increasing indignation against the foreigners and an increase in patriotic zeal. At last the emperor left the army, and as the most convenient and indeed the only pretext for his departure, it was decided that it was necessary for him to inspire the people in the capitals and arouse the nation in general to a patriotic war. And by this visit of the emperor to Moscow, the strength of the Russian army was trebled. He left in order not to obstruct the commander-in-chief's undivided control of the army, and hoping that more decisive action would then be taken. But the command of the armies became still more confused and enfeebled. Bennigsen, the Tsarevich, and a swarm of adjutants general remained with the army to keep the commander-in-chief under observation and arouse his energy, and Barclay, feeling less free than ever under the observation of all these eyes of the emperor, became still more cautious of undertaking any decisive action and avoided giving battle. Barclay stood for caution. The Tsarevich hinted at treachery and demanded a general engagement. Lubomirsky, Bronitsky, Vlocky, and the others of that group stirred up so much trouble that Barclay, under pretext of sending papers to the emperor, dispatched these Polish adjutants general to Petersburg and plunged into an open struggle with Bennigsen and the Tsarevich. At Smolensk, the armies at last reunited, much as Bagration disliked it. Bagration drove up in a carriage to the house occupied by Barclay. Barclay donned his sash and came out to meet and report to his senior officer, Bagration. Despite his seniority in rank, Bagration, in this contest of magnanimity, took his orders from Barclay, but having submitted, agreed with him less than ever. By the emperor's orders, Bagration reported direct to him. He wrote to Arakcheyev, the emperor's confidant, "It must be as my sovereign pleases, but I cannot work with the minister," meaning Barclay. "For God's sake, send me somewhere else, if only in command of a regiment. I cannot stand it here. Headquarters are so full of Germans that a Russian cannot exist, and there is no sense in anything. I thought I was really serving my sovereign and the fatherland, but it turns out that I am serving Barclay. I confess I do not want to." The swarm of Bronitskys and Vinzingeroders and their like still further embittered the relations between the commanders-in-chief, and even less unity resulted. Preparations were made to fight the French before Smolensk. A general was sent to survey the position. This general, hating Barclay, rode to visit a friend of his own, a corps commander, and having spent the day with him, returned to Barclay and condemned as unsuitable from every point of view the battleground he had not seen. While disputes and intrigues were going on about the future field of battle, and while we were looking for the French, having lost touch with them, the French stumbled upon Neverovsky's division and reached the walls of Smolensk. It was necessary to fight an unexpected battle at Smolensk to save our lines of communication. The battle was fought, and thousands were killed on both sides. Smolensk was abandoned contrary to the wishes of the emperor and of the whole people. But Smolensk was burnt by its own inhabitants, who had been misled by their governor. And these ruined inhabitants, setting an example to other Russians, went to Moscow thinking only of their own losses, but kindling hatred of the foe. Napoleon advanced farther, and we retired, thus arriving at the very result which caused his destruction. Chapter 2. Prince Nikolai Bolkonsky's inability to understand the war. The day after his son had left, Prince Nikolai sent for Princess Maria to come to his study.
"Well, are you satisfied now?" said he. "You've made me quarrel with my son. Satisfied, are you? That's all you wanted. Satisfied? It hurts me. It hurts. I'm old and weak, and this is what you wanted. Well, then, gloat over it. Gloat over it."
After that, Princess Maria did not see her father for a whole week. He was ill and did not leave his study. Princess Maria noticed to her surprise that during this illness the old prince not only excluded her from his room, but did not admit Mademoiselle Bourienne either. Tikhon alone attended him. At the end of the week, the prince reappeared and resumed his former way of life, devoting himself with special activity to building operations and the arrangement of the gardens, and completely breaking off his relations with Mademoiselle Bourienne. His looks and cold tone to his daughter seemed to say, "There, you see? You plotted against me, you lied to Prince André about my relations with that Frenchwoman, and made me quarrel with him, but you see, I need neither her nor you." Princess Maria spent half of every day with little Nikolai, watching his lessons, teaching him Russian and music herself, and talking to Dessal. The rest of the day she spent over her books with her old nurse, or with God's folk, who sometimes came by the back door to see her. Of the war, Princess Maria thought as women do think about wars. She feared for her brother who was in it, was horrified by and amazed at the strange cruelty that impels men to kill one another, but she did not understand the significance of this war, which seemed to her like all previous wars. She did not realize the significance of this war, though Dessal, with whom she constantly conversed, was passionately interested in its progress and tried to explain his own conception of it to her. And though the God's folk who came to see her reported in their own way the rumors current among the people of an invasion by Antichrist, and though Julie, now Princess Drubetskaya, who had resumed correspondence with her, wrote patriotic letters from Moscow. "I write you in Russian, my good friend," wrote Julie in her Frenchified Russian, "because I have a detestation for all the French, and the same for their language, which I cannot support to hear spoken. We in Moscow are elated by enthusiasm for our adored emperor. My poor husband is enduring pains and hunger in Jewish taverns, but the news which I have inspires me yet more. You heard probably of the heroic exploit of Raevsky, embracing his two sons and saying, 'I will perish with them, but we will not be shaken.' And truly, though the enemy was twice stronger than we were unshakable. We pass the time as we can, but in war as in war. The princesses Aline and Sophie sit whole days with me, and we, unhappy widows of live men, make beautiful conversations while we scrape cloth to make lint. Only you, my friend, are missing," and so on. The chief reason Princess Maria did not realize the full significance of this war was that the old prince never spoke of it, did not recognize it, and laughed at Dessal when he mentioned it at dinner. The prince's tone was so calm and confident that Princess Maria unhesitatingly believed him. All that July the old prince was exceedingly active and even animated. He planned another garden and began a new building for the domestic serfs. The only thing that made Princess Maria anxious about him was that he slept very little, and instead of sleeping in his study as usual, changed his sleeping place every day. One day he would order his camp bed to be set up in the glass gallery, another day he remained on the couch or on the lounge chair in the drawing-room and dozed there without undressing, while, instead of Mademoiselle Bourienne, a serf boy read to him. Then again he would spend a night in the dining-room. On August 1st, a second letter was received from Prince André. In his first letter, which came soon after he had left home, Prince Andrei had dutifully asked his father's forgiveness for what he had allowed himself to say, and begged to be restored to his favour. To this letter the old prince had replied affectionately, and from that time had kept the Frenchwoman at a distance. Prince Andrei's second letter, written near Vitebsk, after the French had occupied that town, gave a brief account of the whole campaign, enclosed for them a plan he had drawn and forecasts as to the further progress of the war. In this letter, Prince Andrei pointed out to his father the danger of staying at Bald Hills, so near the theatre of war, and on the army's direct line of march, and advised him to move to Moscow. At dinner that day, on Dessal mentioning that the French were said to have already entered Vitebsk, the old prince remembered his son's letter.
"There was a letter from Prince Andrei today,"
he said to Princess Maria.
"Haven't you read it?"
"No, father," she replied in a frightened voice. She could not have read the letter, as she did not even know it had arrived.
"He writes about this war,"
said the prince, with the ironic smile that had become habitual to him in speaking of the present war.
"That must be very interesting," said Dessalles. "Prince André is in a position to know."
"Oh, very interesting," said Mademoiselle Bourienne.
"Go and get it for me," said the old prince to Mademoiselle Bourienne. "You know, under the paperweight on the little table."
Mademoiselle Bourienne jumped up eagerly.
"No, don't," he exclaimed with a frown. "You go, Mikhail Ivanovich."
Mikhail Ivanovich rose and went to the study. But as soon as he had left the room, the old prince, looking uneasily round, threw down his napkin and went himself.
"They can't do anything. Always make some muddle," he muttered.
While he was away, Princess Maria, Dessalles, and Mademoiselle Bourienne, and even little Nikolai, exchanged looks in silence. The old prince returned with quick steps, accompanied by Mikhail Ivanovich bringing the letter and a plan. These he put down beside him, not letting anyone read them at dinner. On moving to the drawing-room, he handed the letter to Princess Maria, and spreading out before him the plan of the new building and fixing his eyes upon it, told her to read the letter aloud. When she had done so, Princess Maria looked inquiringly at her father. He was examining the plan, evidently engrossed in his own ideas.
"What do you think of it, Prince?" Dessalles ventured to ask.
I?
Said the prince, as if unpleasantly awakened, and not taking his eyes from the plan of the building.
"Very possibly the theatre of war will move so near to us that the..."
"The theatre of war," said the prince. "I have said and still say that the theatre of war is Poland, and the enemy will never get beyond the Niemen."
Dessalles looked in amazement at the prince, who was talking of the Niemen when the enemy was already at the Dnieper. But Princess Maria, forgetting the geographical position of the Niemen, thought that what her father was saying was correct.
"When the snow melts, they'll sink in the Polish swamps. Only they could fail to see it,"
the prince continued, evidently thinking of the campaign of 1807, which seemed to him so recent.
"Bennigsen should have advanced into Prussia sooner. Then things would have taken a different turn."
"But, Prince," Dessalles began timidly, "the letter mentions Vitebsk."
"Ah, the letter, yes," replied the prince peevishly. "Yes, yes."
His face suddenly took on a morose expression. He paused.
"Yes, he writes that the French were beaten at what river is it?"
Dessalles dropped his eyes.
"The prince says nothing about that," he remarked gently.
"Doesn't he? But I didn't invent it myself."
No one spoke for a long time.
"Yes, yes. Well, Mikhail Ivanovich," he suddenly went on,
raising his head and pointing to the plan of the building,
"tell me how you mean to alter it."
Mikhail Ivanovich went up to the plan, and the prince, after speaking to him about the building, looked angrily at Princess Maria and Dessalles and went to his own room. Princess Maria saw Dessalles' embarrassed and astonished look fixed on her father, noticed his silence, and was struck by the fact that her father had forgotten his son's letter on the drawing-room table. But she was not only afraid to speak of it and ask Dessalles the reason of his confusion and silence, but was afraid even to think about it. In the evening, Mikhail Ivanovich, sent by the prince, came to Princess Maria for Prince Andrei's letter, which had been forgotten in the drawing-room. She gave it to him, and unpleasant as it was to her to do so, ventured to ask him what her father was doing.
"Always busy," replied Mikhail Ivanovich with a respectfully ironic smile, which caused Princess Maria to turn pale.
"He's worrying very much about the new building. He has been reading a little, but now," Mikhail Ivanovich went on, lowering his voice, "now he's at his desk. Busy with his will, I expect."
One of the prince's favourite occupations of late had been the preparation of some papers he meant to leave at his death, and which he called his will.
"And Alpátych is being sent to Smolensk?" asked Princess Maria.
"Oh, yes. He has been waiting to start for some time."
Chapter 3. Prince Nikolai Bolkonski sends Alpátych to Smolensk. When Mikhail Ivanovich returned to the study with the letter, the old prince, with spectacles on and a shade over his eyes, was sitting at his open bureau with screened candles, holding a paper in his outstretched hand, and in a somewhat dramatic attitude was reading his manuscript, his remarks, as he termed it, which was to be transmitted to the emperor after his death. When Mikhail Ivanovich went in, there were tears in the prince's eyes, evoked by the memory of the time when the paper he was now reading had been written. He took the letter from Mikhail Ivanovich's hand, put it in his pocket, folded up his papers, and called in Alpátych, who had long been waiting. The prince had a list of things to be bought in Smolensk, and walking up and down the room past Alpátych, who stood by the door, he gave his instructions.
"First, notepaper. You hear? 8 quires, like this sample, gilt-edged. It must be exactly like the sample. Varnish, sealing wax, as in Mikhail Ivanovich's list."
He paced up and down for a while and glanced at his notes.
"Then hand to the governor in person a letter about the deed."
Next, bolts for the doors of the new building were wanted, and had to be of a special shape the prince had himself designed, and a leather case had to be ordered to keep the will in. The instructions to Alpátych took over 2 hours, and still the prince did not let him go. He sat down, sank into thought, closed his eyes, and dozed off. Alpátych made a slight movement.
"Well, go, go. If anything more is wanted, I'll send after you."
Alpátych went out. The prince again went to his bureau, glanced into it, fingered his papers, closed the bureau again, and sat down at the table to write to the governor. It was already late when he rose after sealing the letter. He wished to sleep, but he knew he would not be able to, and that most depressing thoughts came to him in bed. So he called Tichon and went through the rooms with him to show him where to set up the bed for that night. He went about looking at every corner. Every place seemed unsatisfactory. But worst of all was his customary couch in the study. That couch was dreadful to him, probably because of the oppressive thoughts he had had when lying there. It was unsatisfactory everywhere. But the corner behind the piano in the sitting room was better than other places. He had never slept there yet. With the help of a footman, Tichon brought in the bedstead and began putting it up.
"That's not right, that's not right," cried the old prince,
and himself pushed it a few inches from the corner and then closer in again.
"Well, at last I've finished. Now I'll rest," thought the prince, and let Tichon undress him.
Frowning with vexation at the effort necessary to divest himself of his coat and trousers, the prince undressed, sat down heavily on the bed, and appeared to be meditating as he looked contemptuously at his withered yellow legs. He was not meditating, but only deferring the moment of making the effort to lift those legs up and turn over on the bed.
How hard it is! Oh, that this toil might end and you would release me," thought he.
Pressing his lips together, he made that effort for the 20,000th time and lay down. But hardly had he done so before he felt the bed rocking backwards and forwards beneath him, as if it were breathing heavily and jolting. This happened to him almost every night. He opened his eyes as they were closing.
"No peace, damn them," he muttered,
angry he knew not with whom.
"Ah, yes, there was something else important, very important, that I was keeping till I should be in bed. The bolts? No, I told him about them. No, it was something in the drawing-room. Princess Maria talked some nonsense. Dessal, that fool, said something in my pocket. Can't remember. Tichon, what did we talk about at dinner?"
"About Prince Mikhail."
"Be quiet, be quiet."
The prince slapped his hand on the table.
"Yes, I know. Prince Andrei's letter. Princess Maria read it. Dessal said something about Vitebsk. Now I'll read it.
He had the letter taken from his pocket, and the table, on which stood a glass of lemonade and a spiral wax candle, moved close to the bed, and putting on his spectacles he began reading. Only now, in the stillness of the night, reading it by the faint light under the green shade, did he grasp its meaning for a moment.
The French at Vitebsk? In 4 days' march they may be at Smolensk. Perhaps are already there. Tikhon!
Tikhon jumped up.
No, no, I don't want anything,
he shouted. He put the letter under the candlestick and closed his eyes, and there rose before him the Danube at bright noonday, reeds, the Russian camp, and himself a young general without a wrinkle on his ruddy face, vigorous and alert, entering Potyomkin's gaily coloured tent, and a burning sense of jealousy of the favourite agitated him now as strongly as it had done then. He recalled all the words spoken at that first meeting with Potyomkin, and he saw before him a plump, rather sallow-faced, short, stout woman, the Empress Mother, with her smile and her words at her first gracious reception of him, and then that same face on the catafalque, and the encounter he had with Zubov over her coffin about his right to kiss her hand.
Oh, quicker, quicker! To get back to that time, and have done with all the present. Quicker, quicker! And that they should leave me in peace.
Chapter 4. The Bombardment of Smolensk. Bald Hills, Prince Nikolai Bolkonski's estate, lay 40 miles east from Smolensk and 2 miles from the main road to Moscow. The same evening that the prince gave his instructions to Alpátych, Dessal, having asked to see Princess Maria, told her that as the prince was not very well and was taking no steps to secure his safety, though from Prince Andrei's letter it was evident that to remain at Bald Hills might be dangerous, he respectfully advised her to send a letter by Alpátych to the provincial governor at Smolensk, asking him to let her know the state of affairs and the extent of the danger to which Bald Hills was exposed. Dessal wrote this letter to the governor for Princess Maria. She signed it, and it was given to Alpátych, with instructions to hand it to the governor and to come back as quickly as possible if there was danger. Having received all his orders, Alpátych, wearing a white beaver hat, a present from the prince, and carrying a stick as the prince did, went out accompanied by his family. 3 well-fed roans stood ready harnessed to a small conveyance with a leather hood. The larger bell was muffled, and the little bells on the harness stuffed with paper. The prince allowed no one at Bald Hills to drive with ringing bells, but on a long journey Alpátych liked to have them. His satellites, the senior clerk, a counting-house clerk, a scullery maid, a cook, 2 old women, a little page-boy, the coachman, and various domestic serfs, were seeing him off. His daughter placed chintz-covered down cushions for him to sit on and behind his back. His old sister-in-law popped in a small bundle, and one of the coachmen helped him into the vehicle.
"There, there! Women's fuss! Women, women!" said Alpátych, puffing and speaking rapidly, just as the prince did, and he climbed into the trap.
After giving the clerk orders about the work to be done, Alpátych, not trying to imitate the prince now, lifted the hat from his bald head and crossed himself 3 times.
"If there is anything, come back, Yakov Alpátych. For Christ's sake, think of us!" cried his wife, referring to the rumours of war and the enemy.
"Women, women! Women's fuss,"
muttered Alpátych to himself, and started on his journey, looking round at the fields of yellow rye and the still green, thickly growing oats, and at other quite black fields just being ploughed a second time. As he went along, he looked with pleasure at the year's splendid crop of corn, scrutinised the strips of rye field, which here and there were already being reaped, made his calculations as to the sowing and the harvest, and asked himself whether he had not forgotten any of the prince's orders. Having baited the horse 2 times on the way, he arrived at the town toward evening on the 4th of August. Alpátych kept meeting and overtaking baggage trains and troops on the road. As he approached Smolensk, he heard the sounds of distant firing, but these did not impress him. What struck him most was the sight of a splendid field of oats in which a camp had been pitched and which was being mown down by the soldiers, evidently for fodder. This fact impressed Alpátych, but in thinking about his own business he soon forgot it. All the interests of his life for more than 30 years had been bounded by the will of the prince, and he never went beyond that limit. Everything not connected with the ex-